Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the Eastern Border. Surprisingly enough, this episode continues our series on the Lenin and Russian Revolution and all the mess that happened around it. Now, this episode was supposed to be about Lenin in his youth years, so to speak, from the time when he turned 17 and finished college in 1893 up until Russian Revolution, basically about what Lenin did during the meantime, kind of glossing over the 1905 revolution as we covered that in the last episode. Now, the problem with this was that it turns out that Lenin is a bit of a bum. Oh, he's an interesting person, but what he does is, so to speak, weird. And mostly everything that has been documented is about more what about he wrote than what he actually did. So I want to speak about this period, and I want to make sure that everything is clear and that we can move on. But, you know, we need interesting stuff that we can listen to. So I have called to my aid Professor CJ, which you might know from Dangerous History Podcast. He's a colleague from Dark Myths, a very good friend of mine, and, a very knowledgeable person when it comes to revolutions and rebelling against things, as far as I know. P.S. Check out his show. Hi, CJ.
Hey. Good to be here.
Oh yeah, you. By the way, you've been on PDRP, but you haven't been on the Eastern Border. So why don't you give us a short version of what you're doing and who you are?
Sure. Yeah, I do a podcast called the Dangerous History Podcast, and you can go to dangeroushistorypodcast.com to get to the homepage there. And I cover history from a point of view that's basically, for lack of a better term, individualist anarchist or market anarchist. And so, as such, I'm always very hostile to and skeptical to power. And usually where you find the biggest concentrations of power in the modern world is in the hands of the state. And so oftentimes those people and the people that are connected to it tend to end up in my crosshairs. So a much more cynical view towards those sorts of characters, the presidents, the kings, the prime ministers, and so forth, than you usually get in history.
Well, that's what we're doing here as well, essentially, this is one of the episodes where I just don't know where to start, because we moved on to the killing of Alexander, the Lenin's brother, who tried to kill the Tsar. So, you know. So Lenin is 17. He finishes college, and this is where I started running into troubles. The first thing is that, you know, I have all these piles of books of, you know, Soviet books on Lenin. And obviously, as with every possible great leader, and I don't know, maybe it's something like you have an America with your founding fathers, I'm reading these books, and essentially, in children's books, school textbooks, the first thing written about Lenin in your Soviet history book was that he was a great humanitarian. Like, you open your 10th grade Soviet history textbook. You want to know what Lenin is from Soviet viewpoint. I opened up the part where it started to speak about Lenin, and the first thing was, I found out about 3 pages worth of what a great person Lenin was, and how he gave books to children, and what an awesome dude he was, and that he had very high moral characteristics. And after three pages of that nonsense, there was some few lines, and then there were some few lines about what he actually did. Because later on, sure, there were chapters on revolution, but when it comes to Lenin, I doubt that you should start your description of a historical persona by describing how awesome this man was for three books. So this is where confusion begins in this episode.
Yeah, well, usually when you start reading about somebody and you're immediately running into this sort of hagiography, this treating someone as if they're a saint or a hero, to me, that should be, pardon the term, a red flag to make you kind of have a little bit of skepticism, because that's not normal, and it's probably bullshit.
Well, for the most part, also a red flag in this episode. Excellent. What we can get from Lenin's eyewitness accounts and everything. See, Lenin starts to basically hang around for a bit after he's finished college, and after this murder of his brother. Well, he calls it murder. It was an execution, which is essentially murder if you think about it. But for a year, he works as an aide to a state lawyer, Nikolai Hardin. But then he just quits the job and moves to St. Petersburg from his near Volga thing. The interesting part is when he quits the job. He quits the job in 1893, you know. Turns 17, finishes, like, college things, goes to have the big life. But also, at this year, a huge, huge, massive famine is there in Russia in winter. Like, all of the near Volga oblast is completely hit by it. And even though Lenin isn't harmed by it, because he comes from quite a wealthy family, like upper echelons of society up there, everyone's basically starving at this point around there. And, you know, as usual, everyone knows each other in the district at that time, because there are not so many people, and his father's a prominent figure in the educational system. So, you know, there are people who are just walking around and, you know, gathering donations to, you know, feed the poor. Because the state isn't doing anything to feed the poor, because it's 1893, and what state support? Those are barely humans. They don't have human rights in Russia, remember that. So, Mr. Ilyich, our good old friend Lenny, decides that instead of supporting his family for this, he writes to the local newspaper that we shouldn't help any farmers with their famine, and this is totally wrong. And he starts writing around his first communistic ideologies there. Basically, he stated that all these massive problems that were caused by this, you know, lack of grain are actually created by evil capitalists and foul bourgeoisie. And, you know, but that is good that the peasants are starving and they are very, very desperate, because then they'll be more radical and they'll be more eager to take up arms. Because, quote, only the peasants driven to the utter desperation will be ready for the revolution. Therefore, giving them food would be ideologically wrong. Starvation plays a progressive factor in all of this. So he utterly refuses to help anyone, and basically yells at his family members who are trying to feed people around them. This is Lenin at 17.
Yeah, that's a kind of personality type I think that we see a lot in those sorts of characters, where a lot of these revolutionary and intellectual types, when you look into the history of their personal lives, they're often horrible to the real people that are actually close to them. They're often horrible to family members and to, you know, people that they have relationships with and so on. And at the same time, they often have the writing and a rhetoric that's all humanitarian, you know, that it's all about the greater good of humanity or the greater good of the nation or the greater good of the working class or whatever. And then when they actually deal with real life, tangible people, it's a totally different story. And there's actually a very interesting book called The Intellectuals, I think it is the title, by Paul Johnson. And I can't remember, it's been a long time since I read that book. I don't remember if he talks about Lenin at all, but he definitely talks about Marx. And he looks into the biography of a lot of these revolutionary and intellectual types like Karl Marx and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, people like that. And he exposes how often their own personal lives and personal behavior is completely at odds with the ideas they claim to stand for. So, you know, Karl Marx claims to be for uplifting the working class, and yet anytime he had personal contact with members of the working class, he tended to treat them horribly. Rousseau famously was for... he advocated raising children in a more positive and loving and peaceful sort of a way, and yet his own children he consigned to an awful French orphanage. He impregnated a poor immigrant woman and treated her like garbage, you know. So, I mean, a lot of these characters are that way. And I think you could also see in the story that you just told, the whole idea of, like, the greater good, the whole idea of you've got to break eggs to make the omelet, you know. So,
yeah, I mean,
people have to starve, but it's for the greater goal of the revolution. So it's all good.
But this kind of goes through, I think, and you make a really good point here, because, you know, one thing that you can call Lenin many names, but he was definitely completely zealous and he was a true believer of the cause.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's... He was a completely fanatical... I mean, only a person this fanatical could do this. And yeah, we had a small discussion before the show, but basically even more about his fanaticism is evidenced by the fact that he hated giving gifts to people. He hated all the birthdays and everything, because he was just obsessed about doing the work done. But he did give gifts to them, but he thought the best gift to give to anyone whatsoever was a book, with one specific rule: that it was written by Lenin himself. And he was fanatical about giving books. He essentially went out of his... He often just walked around the street with a bunch of his, you know, bunch of material written by Lenin, and then he used to just give it around to people. Like, hey, you look nice today. Have a pamphlet. Or, hey, it's your birthday, Grandma. Have a book about socialism and how everything is terrible and how we should totally cause... He did this. And he became, like, famous for this. Apparently... He obnoxiously, aggressively gave gifts for every possible occasion. He gave these books that he had written to everyone. The problem is that I've read his, like, collected works. And the tangent here, I have an academical education. I've gotten my master's degree. The problem is, you know, I'm kind of adept at reading historical texts and all these documents about, you know, political philosophy. Problem is, they're terrible books. They are, at least the later Lenin gets in his writing, he gets slightly better. But that's the biggest issue with reading Lenin, is that he's devastatingly boring. He makes sentences that are pages long. He goes into tangents mid-sentence. And his chain of argumentation is nearly impossible to follow. You know, you can do it on short writings, but, you know, everyone reads Marx in detail. Like, Marx wrote Capital, and you can read Capital, and you can follow the train of thought. You can follow what's going on. You can understand the ideology behind it. But there's a good reason why we only read Marx when studying communistic philosophy at college here, at least in Latvia. I don't know if you had to... But I guess you also should read Marx in humanities abroad. But we never read Lenin. And at one point I started thinking, but why? Why don't we just read Lenin? I mean, he wrote a ton of books, like insane amounts of material. In his complete works, there are 25 volumes of them, and each of these books is like, you know, game, like something you'd expect from Game of Thrones. They're huge books. And when you start reading it, you understand that it's just illogical. It makes no sense. Just as way as I have also read Mein Kampf with commentaries and everything. Just you know, it's a historical document. I want to know what's going on. And that also is a terrible book. Ideologically, you know he did terrible things, but I don't know. I think it's kind of a tradition. The more power-hungry you are and the crazier your ideas, the worse books you write, I presume. I don't know.
That's interesting because... And I've not read much from Lenin other than I probably way back have read, you know, a few excerpts from a few different essays and things from him, you know, translated into English. I think I've read some of his critiques of imperialism and a few other things. And it's long enough ago, I honestly don't remember it very well. But it's interesting that you should say, because I've not read all the way through, but I've read some bits and pieces of Mein Kampf as well. And I definitely remember Mein Kampf being kind of stream of consciousness. It's almost like some guy who's just like really high ranting about stuff. But
yeah, that's the feel of Lenin as well. I mean, if he would give a speech to a crowd, it would, I guess, convey the emotions and rile up the crowd. But when you read it in a book form, then you're like, okay,
What I find really interesting is that so many on the intellectual left, including a lot of Western academics to this day, and who the hell knows how many of them have actually read Lenin firsthand anyway, but amongst a lot of the intellectual left, and most of the real academic intellectuals, at least in the States, are leftists of some sort, Lenin has this reputation as being this great mind, this brilliant intellectual. And of course, no one thinks of Hitler as a brilliant intellectual. And it's interesting to say that like their writings are sort of comparable in being kind of incoherent and badly written. Why on earth would so much of Western academics consider Lenin this brilliant writer and this brilliant mind? That's an interesting question.
Yeah, and this is kind of interesting because I'll get to this later. I found the direct quote about the Lenin's book givings, and this will be amazing. The great leader gave his works to his relatives and acquaintances with a maniacal relentlessness.
Hmm. Yeah, that calls to mind a quote from Winston Churchill, I believe, who said, a fanatic is someone who can't change their mind and won't change the subject. So the person who's pushing their ideas, even when it's clearly not appropriate or when it's clearly not a person who's interested or receptive to them, that's something, you know, I obviously have my own strong beliefs and whatever, but I don't go pushing them on random people who haven't asked for them and aren't at all interested. You know, when I'm talking to my grandma, I don't start ranting to her about anarchism or something, you know. Seems like these hardcore true believer types, you know, the sorts of people who are willing to do things like employ mass violence for their ideas, they often are that way, where they'll just push their ideas on people who are not even remotely interested, where it's wildly inappropriate.
Well, basically, but this is going to continue throughout, because Lenin gets his degree from St. Petersburg through mail, through various hijinks, and starts to type out these revolutionary things. Then Lenin's dad dies, and his dad, being a wealthy person, left 2,000 ruble inheritance to his family. And 2,000 rubles was insane amounts of money for that time. It's, I guess, I don't know. Imagine $2,000 in 1893 money. A ruble at that time was worth more than a dollar. It was also based on gold standard, but it was worth more. I guess it's comparable to us to some sense. I mean, you know, it's a lot of money. Essentially, for $2,000, for 2,000 rubles in 1893, you can feed your family for years and buy a house. And, you know, like you're a rich person in that time. Lenin takes his part of that money and decides to screw this. I'm gonna travel around Europe. Because he decides that, hey, let's just do things. Oh, also another thing, another income of Lenin was that after his father died, as he was essentially, he was a noble, but he was a bureaucrat noble, and that's one of the weirdest concepts which we spoke about last time too. The fact that once you reach a certain rank in bureaucracy, you instantly become a noble. You get to ride to buy serfs. Awesomeness. So Lenin receives a stipend from the state because his father has died, like together with the rest of the family, but some money for him. And Lenin's mom owned a farm in the countryside, which she really, really tried to give to Lenin for a bit. But so before Lenin leaves with his money and his education, which he received, and he had worked as an aide to a lawyer for about a year or so by this point. But before he leaves, his mom decides, hey, that Lenin kid, well, by this point, he's our friend Ilyich. Lenin is, being rude and rowdy. Hey, let's send him to the countryside. You know, I have this farm there. Maybe he'll do some farming life. And seeing how all this workers, proletariat farming thing is important, you might imagine that, you know, Lenin had lived farming life, so he knew the experience. Well, that's a bit of a problem. See, Lenin really kind of gave it a try, but he didn't know anything about farming, that's first. Secondly, he managed to get really hated by everyone around him, because previously he'd been speaking about, you know, letting them all starve. Which meant that actually local farmers from the area stole two cows from Lenin. And Lenin apparently got into fights over this. And he was way more interested into doing anything else but actually taking care of his farm.
Wait a second. You're saying he got upset because someone else confiscated his private property?
Well, yeah, apparently his fellow farmers from around the district just stole two cows from him, yeah.
Hey, how does he know that they didn't need those cows more than he did?
I don't know. This is what I got, but this is hilarious on its own.
Yeah.
Lenin tries farming. Lenin fails.
Yeah.
Lenin tries being a lawyer. Nope.
Yeah.
Lenin's life is all this thing about this. Also, all this time throughout this, Lenin, the great liberator, he was supposed to run the farm and he had a lot of money. And, you know, people, and this owning of a farm moment, of course, was portrayed in Soviet media and Soviet propaganda books as something that, you know, heroic Lenin learns agriculture and evil monarchist farmers betray him at every step. But, you know, actually from documentation, we know that basically he had hired some random servants to work on his property, while during the short time he spent at the farm, he basically got into fights with neighbors, he hunted, and he was a avid mushroom picker. He picked mushrooms in the forest. And that's about it.
Yeah, it sounds like backbreaking labor.
Well, see, and this is the problem with this episode. Lenin doesn't do anything. Lenin is lazy. I guess the name of this episode is Lenin is lazy for a while and things. But yeah, basically after this, the farm is sold, he gets money. He also is a lawyer by this point. So he has his money, and then he goes around with him, and there's a lot of Russian intelligentsia and all these social democrats everywhere around places, and Lenin speaks a lot of languages too, because like I mentioned in the first episode of these series, Lenin spoke fluent French, fluent German. He was really, really educated. He was smart, but he was a kind of a jerk. Now, we have, and he also, you know, he travels around Europe. He reads on Marxism. He actively participates as a hardcore revolutionary in every social democratic meeting, every socialist meeting ever. He goes to Switzerland. He goes to France. He just travels around Europe for a bit. And we have, like, testimonies from these people whom he met, you know, because he goes to every meeting he can get his hands on, quite possibly just to hand out more of his books, you see. So there are testimonies about him, about what Westerners of the time thought about him, and he spent about 10 years there. Then he would later come back. Then he would return to Russia. Then he would spend more years abroad. But basically, while he spends there, he hangs around Europe and writes more of these completely theoretical and insanely hard to comprehend essays and texts. He just pumps them out nonstop because he is extremely prolific, and I have to give him that. And apparently he creates constant scenes, drama, and fights around the social democratic societies and leftists throughout Europe. He couldn't stand Western leftists. My sources say that, quote, almost every meeting or congress ended with a proper yelling, rudeness, like swearing at each other, and quite a lot of these interested people just leaving the whole event, stating that it's impossible to even work together with this usurper Lenin, because Lenin arrives and he wants to be the boss there, and so the leftists of Western Europe where he's traveling just can't stand him because yay, he supports our ideas and he's a social democrat, but this guy is such a pain in the ass. Everyone hates him. Lenin himself, although about all of this, writes in his diaries that he's extremely happy about all of this, because the more these people with their wrong communist thoughts leave, the bigger are the chances of Ilyich to become the true leader of socialism.
Wow.
And another great quote about Lenin and his relationships with his fellow man was created by like this, quote, well, firstly, his rudeness was repulsive. It was also mixed together with an enormous ego, kind of despicable attitude towards the partner of your conversation, and some sort of high-mindedness and visible condescending towards someone with whom he spoke, especially if someone disagreed with him. In arguments, he wasn't ashamed not only to be rude and vulgar, but even allowed himself to basically do complete ad hominems towards his opponent. Therefore, as far as I remember, Lenin never had close friends. He had his comrades, he had his sycophants, who kind of praised him and forgave everything. But yeah. He's this condescending man whom people just can't like personally at all. And one of the shortest and the most interesting and kind of precise, you know, there are these sentences about Lenin. It was given by a poet, Ivan Bunin, during the very first months of the Soviet power, which will come later, but you know, it's still it's already there. And Ivan Bunin wrote about this, essentially this quote. Soviet Congress, speech of Lenin. Wow, now that's an animal. So it's interesting enough, because I think if Lenin was alive today, he wouldn't like modern-day leftists at all. He would go to the meetings, he would give out the books, and then he would start calling people names and forcing them to leave or something.
What I want to know is, I've often heard that Lenin, you know, aside from in academia here, he's often treated as a brilliant thinker. I've often heard things to the effect that he had some sort of charisma. And yet at the same time, as you're describing him, he sounds extremely unlikable. And so, I don't know, can you kind of square that circle of... I'm guessing he must have had some sort of personal charisma.
Well, I guess so. He spoke with the masses, apparently. But
so he was a good speech giver, but just bad at kind of one-on-one interpersonal relations?
Yeah, of course, because he really was... I guess when it came to small groups, he would be really annoying. But if you would look at him from this podium... and you would be in this Russian farmer situation, then yeah, I guess it's kind of, I guess it would be like that, the fact that he could influence large crowds, but he was terrible personally. For one, he later had major arguments with Stalin, which often are turned in a lot of history books, often are turned into some some argument, especially in the era of de-Stalinization in Soviet history books. He later in his life will have struggles with Stalin, personal struggles about a lot of issues. Because weirdly enough, out of all the things, Lenin was not a Russian supremacist. Stalin was, however, even though Stalin was Georgian himself, weirdly enough. Lenin was a true internationalist. He did terrible things, but, you know, he wasn't a nationalist in any way or form. And because of this, they had a lot of fights with Stalin. And later, of course, all of this in the era of de-Stalinization is portrayed as good Lenin fights against the rights and does things against evil Stalin, and they have this conflict and everything. But yeah, when you think about it, Stalin even got to power because, which many people might not know, but we'll get to Stalin too. I'm planning going through with this for a long time, you see. Stalin met Lenin when he was still known by his nickname Koba. After he had left his seminary, where he was supposed to be an Orthodox priest, he decided to rob banks. He kinda got a run-in with Lenin and decided to fund this little guy. I mean, hey, it's fun. I'll rob banks and give money to Lenin. And Lenin was happy, because, hey, it's just bourgeoisie who are just being robbed. So yeah, later he got into a bit of a pickle with Koba. So that's another evidence of all of this.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point that you bring up, the whole good Lenin, bad Stalin dichotomy, because that's another thing, again, from my perspective here in the States, that you often get from some of the leftist intellectuals, and, you know, I don't mean to say that all the leftist intellectuals and academics over here are actually, you know, full-on communists, not all of them are, but from those who are or who are sympathetic to communism, that's what you often get is, even when you can get them to admit that Stalin was a mass murdering bastard and was horrible, they'll always spin it with, oh, but if only Lenin hadn't died when he did, and if only Stalin, like, they want to, because Stalin was so obviously awful, and it's hard even for leftists to deny that, they then want to act like that means that Lenin must have been good. Even if you want to say that by body count, Stalin was a bit worse, the fact that Stalin is bad doesn't mean that Lenin was good. Like, what if they're both bad? And even, I gotta say, Epic Rap Battles of History, I don't know, have you ever watched Epic Rap Battles of History on YouTube?
Yes, and I have to say, Winston Churchill totally beat Teddy Roosevelt, even though I like Teddy.
Yeah, well, my favorite one, by the way, is the one that starts off as Spielberg versus Hitchcock, and then all the other movie directors jump in. But anyway, one of the ones that I thought was pretty good was, they did one, it's listed as, I think, Rasputin versus Stalin. And actually, what ends up happening is that as it goes on, if you've not seen this one, I'm sure you'd get a kick out of it. It starts off as Stalin versus Rasputin, I think. And then
I know what you're talking about. It starts as Macedonian Alexander versus Ivan the Fourth, and then it escalates through mass murders, I presume, and gets to something.
No. The one I'm talking about, I think it just starts with Stalin versus Rasputin, and then Lenin jumps in. And then Gorbachev, and then Putin, and I might be messing up the order that they jump in, but what's really interesting, and it's a very, very funny epic rap battles, but what's really interesting is, even in that, they kind of portray Lenin as the good guy, and they have Lenin saying something along the lines of, like, damn it, Stalin, I had this awesome revolution going, and then you hijacked it and ruined it. So even Epic Rap Battles of History, of all places, is susceptible to this myth of bad Stalin, good Lenin.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how good Lenin was, because he was, by this point in history, he was, you know, the peasant situation in Russia is getting worse and worse. They have less and less rights. And he's trying to lead these Bolsheviks throughout, you know, after he's gone through Western Europe, he's gotten quite a lot of acquaintances, well, those who stuck around after he kicked out everyone else, and so he's managed to wiggle his way and start all this Bolshevism by this point, which at this point has been called Socially Democratic Party, but that's beside the point. He writes from his emigration to his people in Russia letters, and these letters are all in his combined works, And when you read them, it's kind of funny because he openly calls for, quote, assault on banks, rob them to acquire more money so that we can finance the uprising. And you know what? Gangs all over the Russia basically followed all of him. And in the time from 1905 up to 1907, the period of the 1905 revolution, in the Caucasus region alone, there were five huge bank robberies, after which basically totally about 700,000 rubles were stolen, which was just astronomical amounts. Like, 2,000 rubles allowed you to travel all over Europe, basically. 700,000 rubles were just insane amounts. But the biggest of these robberies, clearly instigated by Lenin and to finance the communism, was in Moscow, where the revolutionary bandits, with Koba, our friend whose name you should remember, also Mr. later known as Stalin, happened to, like, rob from a bank in Moscow 875,000 rubles. The thing is, Lenin was ecstatic about all of this, because this was one of the last robberies going on there. But Lenin is just sitting and being happy. Look, we're stealing all the bourgeoisie money from the banks. It's going to be awesome. We shoot people and take their money to give all the money to all the people. It's awesome, isn't it? Now, the thing is, this is the one point where Lenin becomes extra furious. Because his colleagues in Moscow, after this robbery, decide that, guys, this is a bit too much. This is Moscow, and this is, like, so much money that this is just insane, and we will get squashed down because, you know, the cops won't let us go. They'll find us and kill us all. And they start to massively panic. And I just imagine this, you know, it's Russia, it's early 20th century, and you're in one of these communist cells, and you walk into your room, and you open the door and say, Ivan, what is this? And Ivan says, well, you know, look, we have this much money, and the money possibly covers, like, half of the room. And then let's call him Oleg. Oleg slowly closes the door, steps back, and says just to himself, well, fuck, or something of that sort. Essentially, they, while Lenin was in absence, quietly voted and signed a small revolution, which basically stated, yeah, let's not rob banks anymore. We are in a bit of a trouble here with the authorities now. Because this whole thing, remember, there are massive robberies like this. And at the same time, they are supposed to be covert and preparing for the real attention. Because, yeah, all these financing issues are alone, just a crazy thing. But this isn't the weirdest thing about how communists acquired money for the revolution. Oh, no. And this is the special case. Lenin is away, but he's actively writing letters to everyone. And this is a special tale, also documented, of course. Essentially, Lenin finds out that there are two sisters. Two ladies, which are the sisters of one of the major Russian factory owners who has recently deceased. And they, apparently, were kind of... they inherited large amounts of money. Of course, Bolsheviks want all that money, even though they have, like, insane amounts of money by this point. Bolsheviks decide that, you know, they choose from their ranks, with approval by Lenin, two extra classy-looking revolutionaries. Like, they pick the guys whose posters you can stamp on t-shirts, like Che or something. They pick two of them, and their task was to basically woo these ladies, get them to marry them, and as soon as they're married, they would instantly acquire the inheritance, which they had signed a paper that they would instantly transfer it to the coffers of the Communist Party. Now, the problems began because one of these guys, when he actually saw the money, categorically refused to, you know, give any of it to his communist comrades. I mean, he's living the good life now. And he actually, now, and the other guy also kind of seeing this was more like skeptical about all of this. What happens next is crazy because our glorious communist people went to these families and like literally threatened them, threw rocks at the windows, broke stuff, and essentially caused trouble for them, as if they were a communist, as if they were a bank. One of these couples managed to escape outside the country. Another one wasn't so lucky, and at the end had to actually part with the money. Well, some of it. He made a deal that he would only give about half of the money to the Communist Party. Nobody cared about how the ladies felt, obviously.
Well, sure.
I read all of these facts here. And I'm thinking, well, should I make a show where I factually describe precise dates when and how Lenin goes to Paris and when he goes to Zurich? Or this? And this is just something that blew my mind and why this episode isn't as conventional as usual, I presume.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, that's very revealing. I mean, it just shows you the sorts of people who don't look at other human beings as sort of equals in the sense of rights and respect and all these sorts of things. They look at other human beings as means to use for their ends. They look at other human beings as pawns to be played for their own game. And, you know, I'm sure that Lenin and many of the others on some weird level believed in the idea of a greater good and an eventual utopia. But at the same time, they're such, like you said, true believers that they're willing to kind of do anything to people that they see as means to get there. You know, they're willing to throw under the bus whoever has to be thrown under the bus. And they break all these eggs, and then somehow you never even end up with the damn omelet.
Well, yeah, and see, this is where we'll end our factual part, and I want to discuss more of a theory, because Lenin, and these are just a couple of anecdotes and stories and eyewitness accounts about Lenin in his youth when he travels around, because he basically, short version is, travels around Europe, comes back for a bit for 1905-1907 revolution, travels around, gets exiled from Russia in 1907, escapes the authorities, travels again around, and we last see him before he returns to Russia in Zurich, where he's getting financed by the German Imperial Germany. That's what he does. But even though there are tons of lists of places where he went and specific congresses he did, this is what happened. This is the feel of it, which I think must be understood. Because after all of this, when he'll come back and he'll actually finish the revolution, which you'll get next time, he'll start to write letters such as this one, and I quote here. Comrades, the revolt of kulaks in five oblasts must be crushed without mercy. It is necessary for revolution, because now the final and decisive battle with the kulaks has begun. We must show example. Number one, hang them. Additionally, written as note, it's important to hang these people in a way that the people would see. You should hang no less than 100 kulaks, rich people, the bloodsuckers. 2. Publish their names. 3. Take away all their food stocks, like all the grain, everything they have. 4. Take hostages in accordance with the order given yesterday. Do it in such a way so that in an area of 100 miles around all this, everyone would know it, they would see it, they would basically be very, very afraid of it, and they would scream very fanatically, kill and destroy these blood-sucking kulaks. Please telegraph me about how you acquired this and how you will fulfill this. Get tougher people. Dot. Your Lenin. End of telegram. So this is amazing. And one thing that I'll post this is that this is even seen in like Soviet propaganda movies and everything. And Lenin grows from this kind of mean child. But when his brother gets hanged, and when he gets into this, all this Marxism, because he just absorbs everything while he's in this Western Europe, and when the revolution of 1905 happens, it's just insane. He basically starts to kill people and everything, and he writes about, another one of his telegrams, and this was from 1980, was, it is necessary to start a violent mass terror against kulaks, priests and all of their supporters. And this is kind of crazy, because all the persons who are even a bit conspicuous must be put into concentration camps outside the cities. That's 1918, people.
I wonder how much of Lenin's hatred for the kulaks was a matter of just jealousy, because he had been such a shitty farmer and obviously the kulaks were good at it.
Yeah, like, those filthy kulaks, they took my cow!
They took my cows and they grew some shit and I couldn't figure it out.
Mushrooms grow themselves, you bastards! Wheat must do that too! I don't know, this is one of these things where I just need to laugh and delve into black humor, because this is a person who led the biggest country on planet Earth, and people really looked at him as the bringer of hope. I mean, you can look at some biblical parallels even here with him and Lucifer to a point, sort of, if you want to, because really, by this point, by the point he takes his massive role in the Russian Revolution proper, when it really kicks off and Mr. Nicholas II is thrown out. Like, last episode I spoke about the atrocities of Nicholas II, right now it's the Lenin's turn, so as we will enter the revolution in the next episode properly, I hope that you listeners have now seen that there are no good guys in this story. They're just, and this is what makes it funny, you know. Normally when you try to do a story from a perspective of one side or the other one, you are always somehow biased, but I just hate both of them, so hey.
Yeah, and then there's the other one that sometimes Western apologists, at least, will trot out, and that's Trotsky. You know, they'll bring out Trotsky and they'll say, "Well, Stalin was a jerk and a monster, but Trotsky, if only Trotsky had been in charge instead," you know, or they'll point to the crimes of Stalin and basically say, "Yeah, you see, if only Trotsky would have won that power struggle."
Oh, that's because Trotsky lost. Okay, so Trotsky lost, and he wasn't in the position to commit any acts of terror.
Yeah, although during the Civil War, my understanding is that Trotsky was really a monster. That he was one of the kind of architects of a lot of the bloodiest things that happened during the Russian Civil War.
Well, obviously you had to be. I mean, you couldn't be on the good side of Tavarish Lenin if you weren't like this.
Right.
I mean, look at what orders Lenin gives you. Okay? So, I don't know. It's kind of interesting thing. And a Russian philosopher, Alexander Pyatigorsky, again, I mention him all the time because I love this person. You know, when I read his books at first, for the first time, they seemed to be like very theoretical. But the more I look at them, the weirder it gets, because he writes about how every major revolution, if you have a violent revolution with very strong leaders, basically, or something like that, if you become enough politicized about this, then they tend to turn into their opposites, essentially. I mean, Nicholas II was a dictator, but then Lenin became this dictator figure, and I don't know. That is one of the reasons why kind of your American revolution, I guess, is special, because I don't know. You didn't. Well, now you have basically corporations running the place, as far as I get it. But I don't know, because this is an interesting fact, because we can see in this Red Revolution the fact how the people turn into their opposites, how they fight for the kind of these ideals, but it kind of goes sour.
Yeah, and in a lot of revolutions, the people who end up taking over, rhetoric aside, once they're in power, a lot of times not only do they take on a lot of the characteristics of the regime that they overthrew, but a lot of times they take a lot of the worst characteristics of the old regime and they just amplify it drastically, you know? So, yeah, the Tsar was a bad guy and he had nasty secret police and all that. And then the Bolsheviks come in and they take all of the things the Tsar did that were bad and they crank them up to 11, you know? And they make the secret police way bigger and way worse. They execute way more people than the Tsar ever did, you know? We see a similar thing with the Jacobins in the French Revolution, where they overthrow the king, and yeah, the king's government wasn't good and had a lot of, you know, oppressive features and things wrong with it. But then next thing you know, the Jacobins are in charge and they're executing people at an exponentially faster rate than the king ever did. You know, so there's a song by The Who that a lot of people know, the British rock band The Who, Won't Get Fooled Again, which has the famous lines in it. It's basically kind of making fun of the whole idea of revolution, and it says things like, meet the new boss same as the old boss, you know. And my feeling is that in most cases when you have a revolution, it's going to end up sooner or later being meet the new boss same as the old boss, but a bit worse.
Yeah, because this is just very weird to know. Well, it gets like there's always gonna be, I don't want to say it's always gonna be this new boss, because there have been some communities where there have been no bosses around on planet Earth. You might not know about them, listener, but they've been there. I don't know what was this very strange republic in Italy which people surprised you with.
Oh yeah,
I had
yeah,
to Google too.
Yeah, yeah, that was one that I hadn't had never heard of before, and I started looking some stuff up about it, and based on what I found, it looked very intriguing. It was, let me see here, the Republic of Cospea. It was in Italy, and it was this little area that ended up not belonging to any state just because of accidents of history. There had been a treaty worked out between the Papal States and one of the other. This is back when Italy wasn't united, when it was a bunch of separate little countries. And just by getting left out of a treaty somewhere, this little place called Cospea was a little stateless society. They didn't really have a government. They kind of had like a, you know, almost like a local city council sort of a thing, but it wasn't really a state. And they seem to have done pretty well for, I think, a few centuries. So, you know, there have been examples in history of people doing okay without rulers. I mean, when I get up in the morning, I pretty much, you know, take care of my family and go to work and do what I need to do and pay the bills. And I do it all without a president or a prime minister or a general secretary or any of those things telling me what to do. And, you know, I don't really need them to take my money to bomb people I've never met either. They just threaten me with prison if I don't pay, so I generally fork it over.
Oh wow! Talking about bombs, this is one of the other, because I went through Lenin's articles and I wrote just interesting scripts from this, and one of the quotes of Lenin is that, well, I look with horror in my eyes, truly with horror in my eyes, that people speak about bombs already for half a year, but they haven't made anyone yet, and no one has been blown up. Work harder, comrades. End quote.
Yeah.
And yeah, he has a bunch of quotes. Lenin, while things are going on in the early 1905, while he's still not there, Lenin instructed the people to like throw their political enemies from the rooftops. Some people should be stoned to death. Policemen should be like boiling water should be poured over their heads. And you know, if you can get some sulfuric acid, you should throw that in their faces too.
Nice. That's exactly the kind of thing a great humanitarian who's building a just and loving utopia would do.
I mean, this is... But I really like the bomb. It's like... I cannot imagine what kind of a person you have to be to write a political letter to your followers and you're building this workers' paradise where you are angry at them for their laziness that they haven't committed any acts of terrorism yet. They need to build more bombs.
Yeah.
I don't know. This sounds more like someone, I don't know. This looks like a parody, really. All of these things look like a parody these days. I mean, you can imagine South Park putting the letters of Lenin into some, I don't know, ISIS bureaucrats. ISIS top-tier bureaucrats sending letters to their lackeys with these texts. And you would laugh at this because it would be on South Park.
Yeah, yeah.
But this happened!
Or Team America World Police. There's that scene where the guy goes undercover and he goes into a terrorist bar and it looks like, you know, almost like the bar from Star Wars, but it's full of terrorists. And he goes in and he's like, "Hey, my name's Ahmed and I'm a terrorist. Anyone in here looking to blow some stuff up? Because I really want to do some terrorism," you know. I mean, it's just like so outlandish. It does sound made up.
In 1917, at one point in his life, in 1917 or early 1919, I don't have a precise date, but apparently Lenin had been nominated to Nobel Peace Prize for the triumph of the ideas of peace, because he had stopped, because he had kind of taken Russia out of World War I.
Yeah. Yeah, never mind why and what he then did internally in the country.
Now, also Nobel Peace Prize. This is a personal rant here. Nobel Peace Prize means way less than any other Nobel Prize. Nobel Prize in chemistry or other sciences, in my mind, is just way more valuable. Because those are decided by a scientific committee. Nobel Peace Prize is a random thing awarded from a different institution around there. It's kind of weird. Nobel Peace Prize has been given to the weirdest people for the weirdest reasons, for even promises of things. And the biggest problem with the Nobel Prize is that you have to be alive to get it. So you can't get Nobel Peace Prize after, you know, a lifetime of achievement. You have to give it to someone who's doing it right now.
Yeah.
And that just turns weird. I mean, Obama got Nobel Peace Prize, and even though I have quite a lot of good things to speak about President Obama as well, I do have to mention that he's so far a president who has been at war for a whole 8 years of his term.
Yeah, yeah. Him getting the Nobel Peace Prize, I mean, it's not quite as Orwellian as Lenin getting it, but it's in that.
Lenin was just nominated. Oh, okay, yeah. At the last moment. Someone sane actually looked at this paper and was like, "What the hell are you doing, guys?"
Okay, well, yeah, when Obama got it, first off, when Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize, I think he had been president for like 3 months, you know? He had just barely been sworn in, and they gave it to him. And they gave it to him basically based on he gave some nice-sounding speeches. He had done nothing concrete to really bring about better world peace or anything. And then also, if I remember correctly, while he was giving his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, I believe a drone strike ordered by him blew up a wedding party or something in, you know, one of the places where American drones blow people up, either Pakistan or Yemen or one of these places. So, you know, as the guy is accepting the Peace Prize, he's sending a flying robot to blow up people, most of whom were probably just, you know, unfortunate, innocent bystanders. So, I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
One of the weird themes of all these series of my shows is that people have to be more subtle about their ways, I think, in all ways of life than back then, but it's kind of weird. Oh, and one other thing which will surprise you, CJ, mind you. Another weird fact about Lenin, up until even his role in revolution. You'll be surprised to know that in 1917, most Russian communists didn't even know Lenin existed. Even during the Civil War, when Lenin was the head of the Soviet government, most of the Soviet communists around didn't even know who he was. He was the dude who wrote to his circle, who gave some speeches, but he never made it that big. He got big after this era, in the next few years, in the intermediate period between wars, when massive propaganda machines started working. And there's a simple reason for this. Most Russians couldn't read or write in 1917 at all, and Lenin was away. So, as weird as it seems, Lenin was giving his orders to people, to the closest circle, and then the closest circle dissipated them further. And they knew that they were fighting for this ideal, but the man, Lenin, as he's seen as this face of communism right now, during the dawn of all this, he was not there. He was just, you know, yeah, who, Lenin? Lenin who? Oh, that guy? But he's in Switzerland. Oh, well, must be important. Someone knows him. Okay, well, whatever, man. And this, by the way, is one of the reasons why I don't have that many communist eyewitness accounts about Lenin from Russians. Because Lenin's wife, Krupskaya, spent her life actually doing a weirdly noble cause. Lenin's wife, Krupskaya, actually deserves more of a humanitarian title than Lenin himself, because all she did, and she's way less known than Lenin himself. Lenin's wife spent a boring life, but she basically taught people how to read. She worked in a factory, and then she gathered all the factory workers after that and taught them how to read. Of course, the only thing she had to give people to read was, you know, Lenin's writings, but hey, it was something. So she wasn't as widely known, but she spent her life being, like, actually humanitarian. And like I said, I hope that by this point in our conversation you understand why I got really confused while making this episode. Because there are these moments, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, CJ, because there are moments when you want to do an episode on something and then there is not enough stuff to talk about, and that's bad. But when there is just insane amounts of sources, then you're in trouble as well. And this is just time period. And Lenin is documented. Lenin is one of the most documented people in history, I think. We have everything he has written ever. And it's just right there. And we have everything about him, but there's just so much of it. I don't even know. And yeah, it just got me very confused. But I want to ask you a specific question now. When I think about it, yeah, we have everything Lenin ever wrote. There's a huge 25-volume set, and I'm pretty sure that's public. That's common, like without any authorship rights ever available on the internet. Why do people idolize him then? Because you can like open up one of his books, read about the terror, read about the bombs and the funny, very dark humor stuff, close it, have a good snicker in yourself, and then just live your day. What? Do these people have not read him or something?
Yeah, I mean, I would suspect. I'm the first to admit I've not read very much by Lenin. But I'm...
Oh, you shouldn't. He's a terrible
well,
writer.
I'm also what seems to be a rare sort of person in that I readily admit when I've not read something or not read somebody. And it seems like there's a lot of people walking around, and I, you know, can primarily speak for the States. I don't know if it's different elsewhere, but... In America, there's a lot of people walking around, some of whom have impressive-looking degrees and credentials, and some of whom are just kind of random average people, who have very strong opinions about, you know, books that they've never read. You know, people who've got really strong opinions about the Bible who've never actually read the thing. People who've got really strong opinions about Karl Marx who've never actually read anything by Karl Marx. People who've got really strong opinions about Charles Darwin who've never read anything by Charles Darwin, and so on and so on. I mean, almost any, like, big author or big book you can think of, there's a crap ton of people walking around who have really strong opinions on it who have not even read one page of that book. So, you know, I think that's just a general problem with people overall, that people would rather pretend to know something that they don't know than simply admit that, oh, I've not read that, or I've never researched that, or whatever. And so I think a lot of the people who are walking around thinking that Lenin's a great guy and whatever have probably read little or nothing that he actually said, that he actually wrote.
Well, yeah, I've noticed this situation, and especially, and I've also noticed that a lot of these people who pretend to be these extra specialists are usually very pretentious about what they have read. They're the kind of, you know, there was in the Soviet era, and Soviet era books were really cheap, and there was this there was this similar category of people, because you know you had to like show your status around as an. And you had, like, no one had any wealth to flaunt, so you had to show that you were, like, really, really smart. So people just tended to buy all sorts of books because they were cheap and you looked smarter, and the people just bought books in these huge volumes. And the only way how I obtained these Lenin's combined works is, Lenin was a different thing. You know, you basically bought all the books from Lenin, put them in your shelf, never read them. If the nice man from KGB came to your apartment, they saw, oh well, you have Lenin's combined works there. Well, you must be a communist. You would live in peace. But at the same time, you know, a lot of people have a bunch of classics and all sorts of books in their shelves which they just buy for show. And that's kind of weird for me. But hey, that's how I got my Soviet library. And I do have to admit, by this point, I am well-versed in, history, especially Soviet history, philosophy, and journalism, some political events. I don't think I have much knowledge in anything else.
Yeah, well...
Oh, no, I can fix my plumbing.
Well, that's good. At least some of the knowledge is useful. It's not all just abstract theoretical stuff.
I guess so. I don't know. This is one of the kind of practical things. Oh boy. We're getting, by the way, an election here soon as well in Latvia, and we have some. You know, when you read these things, one thing that I always think about is political advertisements, because all these Lenin's writings and all these political writings of that era actually can be viewed as political advertisements. I mean, think about it. There was no political vote for this party culture back when. People just, you know, wrote letters to newspapers for a certain cause. I mean, you know, we have a bunch of interesting, weird sets of letters to newspapers and books published about this. This is some sort of political advertising. I think so. I at least treat it that way. I thought about how political advertisement was born, so.
Yeah, well, you know, it's designed to kind of influence public perceptions and, you know, guide what the masses will support. So, makes sense.
Well, yeah. Well, we've gotten quite far into this confused episode. Okay, I guess it's kind of time to wrap up. If you have any comments or anything, oh yeah, we didn't mention Russian anarchists. Well, if you wanted to speak about them, you can do so now, or if not, promise me you'll do an episode on them. And I'll send everyone there, because, in fact, Russian anarchism is a very interesting thing which many people around these areas don't know, even though everyone here... See, you had Che Guevara in your t-shirts in America. Over here we had Bakunin saying "Anarchia mach poryadk," or "Anarchy is the mother of order," by Bakunin. He was kind of the national punk scene guy. But Bakunin and other anarchists, especially Lev Tolstoy. Yeah, weirdly enough, Lev Tolstoy was an anarchist. You wouldn't have never expected. But Russian anarchism is something that I would love you talking about, because I have to admit, I haven't researched that part yet. I know some things because I hung out with punks and metalheads in my childhood, and I was one, so... But
yeah, there's different strains of anarchism, and I think most of the Russian anarchists were a little bit more, you know, communist anarchist or socialist anarchist or collectivist anarchist or whatever you want to call it, or anarcho-syndicalist, which, you know, isn't my personal flavor. That said, you know, I generally sympathize with them more than I sympathize with the Bolsheviks. And I'll just share the one Bakunin quote that I can remember, and it's been a while since I've read Bakunin, but the one Bakunin quote that I can remember, because I agree with this 100%, Bakunin said, "If you take the most ardent revolutionary and vest him with absolute power, within a year he would be worse than the Tsar himself," which, you know, he wrote that. He died in, what, the 1870s or 1890s, something like that. So he was way back, you know, decades before the Bolshevik Revolution. He already saw what would happen, that once these people got power, they'd be worse than the Tsar.
Yeah, because weirdly enough, and this might shock you listeners, because I don't expect you listeners to be familiar with anarchism, philosophy, and things like that, but... You'll be surprised, 90% of all the anarchists and influential writers are absolute pacifists.
Yeah.
Anarchism, just because people tell you on the internet that anarchists are, you know, your typical angry punks from the media, no. anarchism is, as far as I know, and I don't agree with anarchism, with all the writings, obviously, because there are many different strains of it. Anarchists are the most pacifistic nice guys you can find.
Yeah, most of the time that's true. I mean, I've gone to events and festivals here where a lot of the people there are anarchists of one type or another, and I mean, you won't find more friendly people who, you know, they're not all pacifists. Some of them, like me, believe in a right to self-defense. But
well, what I meant with pacifism is that you don't want to go aggressively out and oppress other people to follow anarchism.
Yeah, exactly. That's stupid. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Opposed to aggression, opposed to being the aggressor, I think is a good way to put
it.
Which generally means being opposed to state violence, because most of the time state violence is aggression or is built on aggression or built on the threat of aggression. The only, I guess, maybe you could say sort of state violence that isn't built on aggression is if another state is invading a state and the state is fighting a truly defensive war. I suppose you could argue that that is defensive, but there's really not much else the state does that isn't built on one level or another on aggression. So, but anyway, yeah, I mean, the people who grab all the attention are the self-proclaimed anarchists who are, you know, the jackasses out in the street, lighting small businesses on fire and beating up innocent people in riots and what have you. And, you know, to think that those people represent most anarchists is completely not true. And in fact, probably most of the ski mask wearing jackasses, if you sat them down and asked them to explain the philosophies of anarchism, you would get nothing, or at least get nothing that made any damn sense.
Yeah, I guess, because I don't know. My problem with this is, Owen, we're getting into longness here, but what I think is that people sometimes tend to care too much about what other people think or do with themselves and their private lives. That's where the problem starts. When you are not just happy about how you live your day, but you need to poke him, you need to poke that other person and tell him, you're doing it wrong. And then groups of them come together, form a state, and tell this other person, hey, we don't like what you're doing here. Stop doing it. It's wrong. That, I think, is the problem. I mean, as long as it's not hurting anyone else, you should be able to do whatever you please, in my eyes.
Well, I agree with that.
And with this, on this positive note, let us finish this episode, which is apparently very chaotic, but I hope it makes some sense. At least we spoke about some nice things at the end.
Okay.
CJ, any last words for you? Please go visit Prof. CJ's DangerousHistoryPodcast.org? Or ProfCJ.org.
They can go to ProfCJ.org or DangerousHistoryPodcast.com. Either of those two things will take you to the same place.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org for more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Thank you for listening to The Eastern Border. If you have any comments or specific details you'd like to know, you're welcome to leave it in the comment section on our site, theeasternborder.lv, and we'll rummage even to the western border to find you an answer. Like this podcast? Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or on our RSS feed. Happiness is mandatory. Good reviews and donations feed the farmers of our kolkhoz in the great motherland. The Eastern Border salutes you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.